maybe I'll speak for a while now, and then we'll do some walking meditation, and come back and have time for discussion and hopefully another sitting in loving kindness. So I want to go back to the overall context I started to lay out yesterday, which is quite familiar to many of you, which is these four qualities, which are often spoken about together as a bundle, known as the four Brahma-viharas. Brahma means celestial or supreme. Other translation I heard of the word Brahma I liked a lot is best, the word best. Vihara means dwelling or abiding or home. And so taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. And like any home, we may not be there all the time. Certainly we leave. But when we get back, there is a certain feeling. It should be the place where we feel the least pretentious, the most authentic, the most ability to just be ourselves, to be relaxed. We're home. So these four qualities are said to form our best home. And they're all related to one another, and yet they can be distinguished from one another in terms of texture, flavor, things that challenge the quality, even elements that might support the quality the most sometimes can be distinguished. So that's how it's all laid out in the Buddhist psychology. The first home for us, the first Brahma-vihara, is loving kindness itself, or metta, M-E-T-T-A, Pali. Loving friendliness, as somebody just offered me this morning as a translation. It is really that sense of connection. It's an acknowledgement of the connection that actually is. It's not trying to forge a kind of artificial bond. The sense of connection is actually the truth of how things are. However alone we might feel, however cut off we might feel, in effect, we actually are a part of a great web of life. That's how things are. And so metta is the responsiveness to that. Very often, metta, loving kindness, is confused with a kind of passivity, a saccharine sweetness, a sense of being unable to take a strong stand to be effective. And so for that, I'd like to switch for a moment, or to talk about that, I'd like to switch for a moment to another model. Let's see, I need a prop. Did I have a... Okay. again, within the context of the Buddhist teaching, and really Eastern teaching as a whole, the first thing to look at in terms of any action we take, anything we do, anything we say, is the motive. It's the intention that is underlying the action. Because that's where the energy of the action is said to be. So let's say I have this sitting here on my table, this platter. All anybody sees is my hand reaching down, picking up an object. But the real question to begin with is, what's in my heart as I pick up this flyer and move it forward? Maybe I'm offering it to you because I love you and I want you to have it. Or maybe I'm offering it to you because I, you know, just gave a whole big talk on generosity and I thought, oh, well, you know, everyone's watching. They can see me, you know, give you the flyer. Or maybe I'm giving you the flyer because I don't like you, and I know Joseph's very likely to say something that will really annoy you. Yeah, I'm a flyer. I'm go-go you. you know, or a million other possibilities. So the energy or the power of the action within that framework of the Buddha's teaching is not said to be in my hand, picking up something and moving it forward. It's in the motivation or the intention that sparks it. And motivation is what distinguishes one act from what might seem on the surface to be a completely identical act, but is actually coming from a very different place. So is our generosity actually generosity? Maybe it's a sense of martyrdom. We don't deserve to have anything. We need to give it away. Maybe it's really a medium of exchange, like I'll give you this thing because I see you have that thing. I want that thing, you know. I think, hey, very likely, I'll give you this thing, you'll give me that thing. Or so many possibilities. So is it actually generosity? Can't quite tell from your hand. So the potency, classically in Buddhism we say the karmic seed is planted with the motivation, because that's where the energy is. It's a little different than a lot of common Western thought about, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions and so on. It's really a very potent thing, and it's a rich area for investigation, because only we can know our motivation. I mean, we might be very sensitive to others and kind of guess well, but still a guess. Only really we can know where we're coming from. And so we use mindfulness and the development of mindfulness to be much more aware of what our motives might be. And it said, both in classical teachings and, interestingly enough, in current neuroscientific and psychological research, it said that if you do a practice like loving kindness practice as a meditation, the arena of the psyche that is transformed is the arena of motivation, of intention, why we do the things we do. So if in general you have been coming from a place of fear in what you do or what you say or what you choose not to do or say, if you've generally been coming from a place of fear and you do a practice like loving kindness meditation, you will find that you are coming from a place of connection. That something has been transfigured within you in terms of what motivates you, what sparks you, what inspires you, the intentions that guide your actions. It just happens. It is like it's a transmutation of that part of our minds, that aspect of our minds. And this I find very interesting, because one of the things that I talk about a lot with loving kindness is the fact that after a certain point, it's not in any way kind of a determined effort. You know, something self-righteous or self-conscious. And you know, my great model for this is the Dalai Lama, where, you know, he's so famous for having said something like, I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. You think about how most of us meet somebody. It's like, really, we hardly notice them. It's all about me. You know, do they like me? How much do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anyone ever before? Oh no, I said something really wrong. They hate me. Can I make up for this? Maybe I better leave. You know, it's really the story of me with tremendous self-preoccupation, which is very different than loving oneself. It's completely different. You know, so I've never met anyone I consider a stranger, and my experience with somebody like the Dalai Lama is that that's true. You know, I've seen him with all kinds of people, all aspects of society, and I don't really get the sense that he's sitting there thinking, oh my God, this person is like so boring, but you know, I am the Dalai Lama. Everybody's looking at me. But it's also not by accident, you know. He's the one who gets up at 3 o'clock every morning and practices for 3 hours. a day before he begins the rest of his day. It's not haphazard, but it becomes just a part of one's being. That sense of kindness, of connection, or just meeting beings where they are. And it becomes a huge resource for us. I saw the Dalai Lama a little over a year ago, almost a year and a half ago, when I went to India. And it was precisely at the time when terrible things, extraordinarily terrible things were happening inside Tibet, and there's huge violence and, you know, really an escalation of what is already a very difficult situation. And I remember him walking into the room, and of course it was on everyone's mind, you know, like, how is he, how, you know, how are things, what's happening, and he walked into the room and he said, "My mind is filled with disturbed thoughts, but my heart is very steady." And you think about that, you know, how can our hearts be steady even as external circumstances are awful? And our minds even have disturbed thoughts because we can rely on something else, you know, which is like a resource for us. And that's an immensity. It's like a huge vision of life and a tremendous sense of connection to all things. And so that's kind of the nature of loving kindness. We are changed in the realm of motivation or intention. And that's also why I would say, just as a kind of side note, that when we do a practice like loving kindness meditation, and it's probably true for all meditation practice, but I know absolutely it is true in a very emphatic way for loving kindness meditation, the changes we will see will not necessarily be when we are sitting formally doing the meditation. We will see it in life, which is where it counts. I can remember a friend took me out to lunch in New York City not too long ago, a few years ago, and it was like one of those confessional lunches, you know. So I just have to tell you that, you know, I've been sitting now for about 3 years, and my practice, my primary practice, is really loving kindness meditation, whether it's my daily sitting or I'm on retreat. And he said, you know, my experience now, 3 years later, when I'm sitting, is not so very different from what it was 3 years ago when I just started out. He said, but I'm like a completely different person. He said, I'm different with myself. I'm different with my family. I'm different ethically. I'm different with my community. And then he looked at me and he said, is that enough? And I said, yeah, I kind of think it's enough. But we can certainly wonder, you know, or berate ourselves like, oh no, still getting sleepy, or whatever it is. You know, but if we persevere, this is what happens. We're just coming from a different place, which is also a more truthful place if it acknowledges the truth of how connected we all are. Okay, so that's the first aspect of an action, is the motivation that is sparking it or generating it. The second aspect of an action, anything that we do or say, is considered to be the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the action. So back to this, you know, maybe out of a beautiful motive, I decide I'm going to hand you this flyer. Maybe I have to stop and think for a moment. Well, you know, I've only got one. There are a lot of people in this room. Maybe everyone else will feel kind of crummy. You know, maybe this is an act best done privately. I should take you aside, you know, and hand it to you. So this assessment in a way of the skillfulness or unskillfulness of an action is based on context. It's based on mindfulness in a bigger sense. It's based on information. It's actually based on our best guess of what's most skillful or appropriate in this situation right now, whatever it might be. And I think it's important to have a distinction between those two aspects, the motivation and the skillfulness, which people often conflate. Because if we join them in a sort of unhealthy way, then we begin to think, well, to come from a loving place can only mean this kind of action, which is like smiling, or being sweet, or being meek, or saying yes, moving, you know, or giving away all our money, or whatever it might be. But really, we can be coming from a very loving place, genuinely, truly, in terms of motivation. And our best guess of what's most skillful in a particular context can be pretty fierce. It can be really intense. It could be saying no. One of the ways I try to describe this distinction comes from the great Indian saint named Pearly Baba, who was famous for, amongst many sayings, one of the things he said was, never throw anyone out of your heart. Never throw anyone out of your heart. And one of my colleagues in the States, this woman Sylvia Borstein, has a kind of addendum to that where she says, never throw anyone out of your heart. You might throw them out of your life, but never throw them out of your heart. And I think, okay, you know, let's get real about this. We need boundaries. We need to take care of ourselves or take care of someone else. We need to give voice to things we feel are wrong. You know, we need to actually pay attention to the context of where we are. So we might be coming from, and hopefully we are coming from, an increasingly loving place, and the evaluation of what's most skillful in any particular situation demands great mindfulness, wisdom, intelligence, listening, and also it actually involves learning skills. We can learn skills of expression, of manifestation, of communication. When I saw the Dalai Lama about a year ago now on the west coast of the United States, he was quite funny, I thought. He said, he was saying something like, perhaps it's not so skillful to say it's warm in the room, because maybe not everyone is feeling warm. Perhaps it's more skillful to say, I am feeling warm. And I was so amused because he reminded me of every communications coach I'd ever heard. Like, use I language. But there's a skill, that's true. You know, if you go to the movies with a friend and you hated the movie and they walk out, you walk out together and they say, that was like the best movie ever made. There's not, you may not feel there's exactly room for you to say, I don't think so, you know. I didn't like it. It's like the friend has now stated the absolute truth to cover all time. It was the best movie ever made. Oh, it's quite different if somebody says, I really like that movie. Then there's some space for all kinds of opinions to come forward. And so he was right, Professor Dalai Lama, and that we learn skills. And so in both of these arenas, there is great possibility for learning, for growth, for change, for practice. So we have motivation and skillfulness of action as obviously related but distinct parts of everything we do. And then the third part of an action is considered the immediate response, which I'll talk about a little later, okay? So that's one model. Thank you. I hope you go. Okay, so back to the Brahmaviharas. In the field of loving kindness, in the development of loving kindness, we are transfiguring the field of motivation. That's what we're actually doing. And as we are developing more and more mindfulness, along with that, we are also able to be more skillful. Because we can pay attention to where we are. We can listen. We can learn. Okay? So the Buddhist psychology has a scheme of description where each of these qualities is talked about in terms of different characteristics and manifestations and functions and so on. So part of that description is what is called the near enemy and the far enemy. The far enemy is a state that's completely opposite. You would never ever confuse it with the actual Brahma-Vihara state. The near enemy is a state that's kudosina, so that it easily could get confused. And yet, if we are very discerning, if we are very aware, if we're really paying attention, we will see very strong differences between the Brahma-Vihara state and the near enemy. But it's only through great discernment that we can discover that. It's quite easy to confuse them. So the far enemy of metta or loving kindness is aversion, which means anger and fear, which in the Buddhist psychology are considered exactly the same mind state, just two different forms. Anger being the outflowing, energized, expressive form, fear being the held in, imploding, frozen form of the same state. And that state is striking out against what's happening, trying to declare it to be untrue, to separate from it, either by pushing it away or shrinking back from it. So that's the far enemy of loving kindness. And it's the practice of loving kindness that tends to dissolve the kind of solid hold that anger and fear can have on us. They may still come, certainly, but it's different when it's not really where we live so much anymore. We can see it for what it is, which is something visiting, born out of conditions, coming and going, and so on. And the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. It's very close, but it's very different. Attachment being, of course, imbued with expectation, demand, conditionality. That's that state, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. I will love you as long as. And of course, it's a common feeling, you know. It's not really a question of trying to eradicate it necessarily, but to really see it for what it is, and to know deeply the difference between loving kindness and a state of attachment, which is clinging, it's holding. It has a kind of forlorn energy to it, because when we cling or we try to hold on, it's like we are in defiance of how things actually are, which is outside of our control and constantly changing. So the Buddha said, in a very homey kind of example, to hold on tightly to that which must inevitably change is like holding on tightly to a revolving wheel. At some point or another in a cycle, we are bound to get run over. We hold and we cling and we try to be in control. It's not going to work. It just doesn't work. And so we're left with this sort of aimlessness of wanting the world, wanting life to be completely different than how it is, and not being able to step out of a kind of fruitless search for an abiding happiness until we just step out. And we see that there really might be some alternatives. We may not exactly know what they are, but we're willing to experiment. And that's the process of the path. We just step back and start experimenting with our hearts, with our minds. We start paying attention in a different way. So attachment and loving kindness, well, we go through a lot of them, you know, a lot of both states in the process of a practice like this. Attachment is reflective of what a friend of mine once called metta with an edge. You know, we're loving kindness with an edge. It's like, get well already, would you? Or, I gave you a week of loving kindness, or I spent all day Sunday doing loving kindness for you. Why aren't you better? The impatience, the demand, the expectation is different than going back to the example of loving kindness as a practice of generosity, although perhaps not material generosity, is a practice where we know the difference between a freely given gift, where we take delight in the act of giving, and when we give something, it's like, okay, thank me, you know, get it together, it's different. I wouldn't be dismayed, however, if in the course of cultivating loving kindness, one finds oneself in the realm of attachment. That's part of our development of greater understanding, kind of seeing the nature of the state like that, and how it inhibits us and keeps us afraid and holds us back and all of those things. You know, so it's part of the great learning process is to see just sort of the nature of that state and to realize we might have an alternative. You know, we might be able to step away from a very familiar and conventional way of being and work to be different, which is the development of loving things. So that's kind of the basic framework of it. So maybe what we'll do before I go into the other three is spend some time doing a walking meditation, doing loving kindness practice, and then throughout the whole rest of the day we'll explore all of the Brahmaviharas. And for those of you who were not here yesterday or may not be familiar with the particular meditation that is walking meditation, doing loving kindness, basically, as we do walking in loving kindness, you can walk at any speed. You can slow down if you want, but you don't need to at all. And since the practice of loving kindness is usually done with the silent repetition of certain phrases, we just carry that out into the walking. Sometimes people like to match the phrases to their steps. Sometimes it's distracting. It's really an experiment for you to make to see what you like better. And it's just a silent repetition of certain phrases. I would suggest, as I did yesterday, that you primarily direct those phrases toward yourself. So you're walking along, and just with a light awareness resting on phrases like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. In the sitting, we generally use three or four phrases, and the walking sometimes has too many. Hello. And here's something you can experiment with as well. Two phrases, three phrases, four phrases, something like that. Directed towards yourself as a sort of base of awareness. It's a very light awareness because you're aware of everything going on around you because your eyes are open. And at the same time, you can rest some attention on the repetition of the phrases, and then, when you hear a bird, or somebody, a person walks by you, or you see a bug, something like that, a being comes strongly into your consciousness, just briefly include them. And then go back to the silent repetition of the phrases for yourself, okay? Do you have any questions just about that instruction? Okay.